Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the removal of a baby great horned owl from its mother at Lancaster County Park is bringing attention to the sport of falconry. But up front, it's no secret that Pennsylvania nonprofit providers of senior housing, health care, and community services struggled with funding and other issues before the pandemic. The coronavirus pandemic has made some of those challenges even more acute. Costs for testing and personal protective equipment are rising, and new residents are entering nursing homes and the system. So what can be done about it? Joining us on today's program is Adam Marles, President and CEO of Leading Edge PA, a statewide association of nonprofit providers, and James Bernardo, President and CEO of Presbyterian Senior Living in Dillsburg. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let me start with you, Mr. Marles. Who and what does Leading Edge PA represent?
Thanks for having me this morning. Leading Edge PA represents a little north of 370 nonprofit, almost entirely nonprofit providers of aging services. So that includes nursing homes, personal care homes, assisted living communities, but also a large number of continuing care retirement communities, as well as things like life programs, adult day programs, home care and home health programs. So pretty much any service that an older adult in the Commonwealth might need is served by membership of our organization.
So how would you describe what your members are going through right now?
Well, I think everybody knows that for the past 13 months, long-term care has been at the epicenter of the pandemic. The people who were most vulnerable and continue to be the most vulnerable to COVID-19 reside in our buildings. We know that COVID-19 is more difficult to handle in congregate settings. So even though we are now to a point where we have vaccinations, where we understand the virus better, where we finally have access to adequate PPE and testing, the fight is not near over for our folks. And I think maybe a little bit of level setting, as you mentioned in your intro, might be helpful. If you look pre-pandemic, we had been stagnating in terms of our reimbursement from the state for 7 straight years. It may be 8 straight years, depending on how this year's budget goes. So by way of background, nursing homes in Pennsylvania are funded generally in 3 different ways. One is through private pay, which would be people's assets or long-term care insurance, things like that. The second is through the Medicare program, which typically funds for about 20 days. And the majority of the people who reside in long-term care in nursing homes specifically, are funded through the Medicaid program. We did a study 2 years ago using publicly available data that showed that the average nursing home in Pennsylvania lost about $45 per person per day for every resident who was reliant on the Medicaid program. For nonprofits, that loss per day per person was about $82. So prior to the pandemic, prior to extraordinary costs and extraordinary struggles on the census side, the number of people in the buildings, we had a real problem that we were trying to deal with, and the pandemic exacerbated that.
When you say loss, clarify that a little bit. A loss of $82 per day. What does loss mean?
So it's as simple as the difference between the cost to provide the care and the amount of money provided by the state to do so.
And that's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure that everyone understood that.
Yeah.
Let me turn to James Bernardo, who is president and CEO of Presbyterian Senior Living in Dillsburg. Ms. Bernardo, let's talk about your facility in particular. I'll ask the same question. How would you describe what you're going through right now, what the facility is going through right now?
Yeah, Presbyterian Senior Living operates 38 communities throughout the region. So we've had a rolling experience through the pandemic. We have a community in Philadelphia. We have communities in Western Pennsylvania, Northern and Southern Pennsylvania. So as the pandemic hit different places, it hit us in a very different way. While it would be easy for me to talk about the financial impact of COVID, just as one organization, we probably spent upwards to $10 million just on costs that are associated with COVID. That goes beyond the cost of providing service to these vulnerable seniors that we are dedicated to. But I think it's important just to flow through the last 13 or 14 months and just think about how our staff had to become the families of our residents. I personally have friends that did not see their parent for 13 months. When they had the opportunity to visit, it was through glass. And at the time when vaccinations became more available and the incident rates came down, we were able to begin allowing visitation, and the joy that brought was amazing. But at the same time, we are in a situation where while our residents and staff were presented vaccines at the very beginning of this whole thing, when vaccines were available, we have not had access to vaccines for staff and residents since that initial distribution in January and February. So we have staff who want to get vaccinated now who can't get vaccinated. We have new residents that come into our community and have to be isolated. If a staff member pops positive, depending on the number, it can impact visitation. So this situation from a social standpoint is far from over. I can't even begin to talk about the financial havoc that it caused. Fortunately, our organization, through good stewardship and prudence, has the resources and to continue to provide those extra expenses that we talked about. But nothing, no governmental program, nothing has been able to yet mitigate the fact that our overall occupancy in all levels of living it pales into comparison where it was last January. Our skilled nursing communities typically run in the low 90%. We've not broken 80% occupancy since last June. Independent living, fortunately, people have the ability to come back, and personal care and assisted living are suffering as well. So it's been a rough, rough journey. And while we all are tired of this pandemic and this virus, our staff and our residents still feel it every day.
And you bring up several points that I want to follow up on, but I want to tell our listeners, if they're just tuning in, we're talking with the president and CEO of Leading Edge PA, Adam Marles. Leading Edge PA is a statewide association of nonprofit providers, and James Bernardo, president and CEO of Presbytery Senior Living, and they're headquartered in Dillsburg. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ms. Bernardo, I have to say that what you just said about not having access to the vaccines since the beginning when they first became available probably is a surprise to many people. I got the sense that when it came to older Pennsylvanians and when they were prioritized, and that we heard that so many were getting vaccinated, that there was a collective sigh of relief that the most vulnerable now have been vaccinated for the most part. It sounds like that sigh of relief may have been a little bit premature, but I have to ask the question, why? Why haven't you been able to get access to the vaccines since the very beginning? And I assume you're talking about December and January.
I have to add, our sigh of relief was probably louder than anyone's because we were living through this. To be perfectly honest, the initial vaccines were made available through a focused program coordinated by the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services that used national pharmacy providers to actually provide either the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccines. We at that time thought that subsequent to the initial push, which did happen, it started in very late December. I think our first community had its first vaccine on December 28th, and it went through February for the first vaccination. What was surprising to us was that program, after the initial push, did not continue. Now, I can say that in the last 2 weeks, we have begun to see some relief to that. And unfortunately, the pause that occurred with the J&J vaccine complicated the situation. But we are told, I have to be honest with you, until I see it, I won't believe it. We are told that institutional pharmacy providers beyond the CVSs and the Walgreens of the world will have vaccine shipped to them. And the pharmacy that we used received confirmation that they will be receiving the Moderna vaccine this week. So it is hopeful that we'll begin to see relief to that.
Adam Marles, is that common throughout the state with some of your members? And I'm not just talking about the vaccine. And again, I almost get the sense that many people thought that the facilities, those that are providing services to older Pennsylvanians, that they had enough vaccines, that they had enough PPE, that the older Pennsylvanians who you described as most vulnerable were in pretty good shape as a result of vaccinations. Is that the case? I mean, are there things that the public is just not hearing about or there isn't enough focus on?
I think what Jim has reflected on is pretty universal across the state. We, I think, generally do have enough PPE, but from a vaccination standpoint, we've talked to all kinds of different providers from all parts of the state who have said at the way that the federal program initially rolled vaccines out to long-term care was in three different clinics. And so we had providers who finished their third clinic with 99% of all residents in their community being vaccinated. But then, as Jim said, there was a gap that has continued in some cases for a couple of months that saw those vaccination rates, because of new residents coming to the community, fall down into the low 80% percentile. So this is a definite issue. We've been working with the Department of Health on it as closely as we can. We are hopeful that this new program that Jim mentioned that will provide vaccine to long-term care pharmacies will be successful. But what we've been dealing with in the interim has been basically a free-for-all, similar to what the rest of the public dealt with early in the vaccine rollout, where even providers of services to older adults were being told, see if you can find a local pharmacy who can help you. And then providers were forced to do the best that they could during that time.
Yeah, Adam, if I could just add to that, let's remember the people that are typically served in nursing homes and long-term care and assisted living and personal care communities. These people are vulnerable. They're oftentimes very frail. Even if they lived in the community in their own home, prior to the pandemic, they were not candidates of people to, you know, go wait in the line at the Philadelphia Convention Center or even at their local CVS. These were people that oftentimes only got out of their house to go to the doctor or go to the hospital. So we have a bunch of people that need long-term care services that are coming to us, and they did not have a vaccine. And oftentimes they come from hospitals, which have apparently much more access to vaccinations than we do, and they come from hospitals without vaccination.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Adam Marles, president and CEO of Leading Edge PA, a statewide association of nonprofit providers providing services to older Pennsylvanians, and James Medardo, president and CEO of Presbyterian Senior Living. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We have a text here from a listener, Josie. Says, many individuals are scared to sign up for the vaccine. What would you say to them? And I'm going to start with you, Adam, on this one, and not just talk about residents, but also about staff, because we have heard a number of reports from across the country that there have been some staff members who have been hesitant to get vaccinated. So let's start with residents and then move on to staff as far as vaccinations go and those who are hesitant.
Sure. I would start with, please get the vaccine. The scientists, the people who are most knowledgeable about COVID-19 and its impacts are all saying, get the vaccines. They are safe. Please do that. We have seen some staff hesitancy for sure, but I think that was due in large part to the way that this rolled out. The vaccine came to long-term care very, very early in its availability. And a lot of people, just like your texter, were worried about being the first. They didn't want to be the one without knowing what the effects were on their neighbors or their friends. And so they were nervous about that. And then by the time they came around and were ready, they didn't have access to it. And I think it's important to remember that a large percentage of the people who work in our field are people who tend to be lower income, may not have the ability to get out to vaccine clinics in the same way that others may, as well as all of the conflicting stories that people are hearing from social media and other places that I hope have now been debunked in most cases, if not all cases. So we have seen vaccine hesitancy, but we have staff members and residents, as Jim was saying, today who want it, who in some cases can't get it because they aren't physically able to get it if they're living in a facility. But for staff members, sometimes they simply don't have the time in their schedules between being parents and workers to go get the vaccine. So we have done everything in our power as providers to have the vaccine available at the place of work so that they can get it more easily. We need to get back to that and quickly to keep the residents safe, to keep the staff safe, and more generally to keep the public safe.
You know, we know so
from,
that
from our experience.
Go ahead, Jim.
For the most part, residents did take the vaccine. Our experience has been the ones that didn't couldn't. Either they had received convalescent plasma therapy, monoclonal antibodies, or had another physical condition that warranted. I think Adam very nicely explained the dynamics that occurred. Remember how people accepted the vaccine at the very beginning. And, you know, we have staff that our vaccination rates very much mirror with a slight improvement over local vaccine hesitancy at the time in which they were administered. We've gone steps further. We have told employees that we will pay them and allow them to take time off if they can, in fact, find find a vaccine. And we've heard plenty of stories about how difficult it was, at least in the first two months of rollout, how difficult it was to get a vaccine appointment. So those staff members that were lucky enough to get those appointments, we allowed them to leave work and paid them to do that. And it helped, but we need, as Adam said, to have it available. People cannot afford to take time off. And, you know, you've heard so much about people not being paid during all of these things. Most not-for-profit providers have paid staff not to come in when they were ill. And if they got ill the day after the vaccination, they were allowed to use paid time off for that as well.
Mm. Let's talk about that.
One additional thing I would add, just in terms of people's concerns about the safety of the vaccine. If you look at the population being served in older adult services, as Jim was saying, these are frail older adults, oftentimes with compromised immune systems. And yet 95 plus percent in many cases of those residents have gotten the vaccine, are fully vaccinated, and have shown no significant side effects after maybe a fever or a headache the day or two after the vaccine. So if the most vulnerable people in our population have safely received this and are benefiting from it, I think the rest of the public should feel reassured that those people with normal immune systems, functioning immune systems, could also feel very comfortable receiving it.
And I just wanted to point out that, you know, we've heard over the past couple of weeks that there are appointments going unfilled because, that there's now a large supply of vaccines. So really, a lot of people can get vaccinated if they want to. I want to change topics a little bit. Something that we've mentioned, we've been talking about staff. And Adam, you mentioned very early on in our conversation about staffing issues before the pandemic even hit. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem, that there's been a high turnover in your industry, high turnover rate amongst employees. And let's face it, part of the reason is that they don't make a lot of money. I don't know what has happened during the pandemic, but what can be done about this high turnover rate? I mean, that has to, at some point, maybe have an impact on care.
Well, let's start with the work itself and recognizing that the people who do it are incredible. So the work that especially our direct care providers are providing are helping with the most intimate daily tasks of a person's life. And in many cases, that includes lifting or bathing or things that many of us would simply choose not to do. And these people come and do it with love every day. So as Jim was saying, we would love to be paying every one of our staff members more. But as I explained briefly at the beginning, the majority of the people who live in nursing facilities in Pennsylvania are reliant on the Medicaid program. Those rates are set by the state and they have not changed for the past 7 years. So what that means is that as the cost of benefits for staff have gone up, as the cost for healthcare supplies have gone up, as general costs have gone up, the providers of services have had no increase in their compensation and no way to increase it because the state sets the rates. So whereas almost every other business in the world, if you're selling pizzas and your staff needs to be paid more, you can charge more for your pizzas. We can't charge more, and so we're constantly trying to figure out where to find those funds. If the state would provide adequate funding for long-term care in Pennsylvania, then I think that would have a significant impact on the turnover because the compensation could be improved substantially.
I just have to say that what you described, Adam, is it does take a special kind of person to do this. But almost get the sense that these people are not valued as much as what they should be, that maybe people don't realize the kind of work that they have to do and that they are working with some of the most vulnerable people in our society. that, I mean, is that part of the problem? Is that it goes sight unseen that that your workers are not valued by society as much as what they should be?
There's no question. There's no question that the people who do this work are heroes. We've heard a lot about healthcare heroes, and we've heard a lot about hero pay during the pandemic. The fact of the matter is these people were heroes before the pandemic. And the pandemic just finally provided a spotlight for their exceptional contributions to society to be recognized. But I think the problem is a little bit bigger than that. And that is, I think, societally, older adults are also undervalued and forgotten. It's very easy when someone is either not able to leave their home or is reliant on services in a congregate setting that the public doesn't see them. And so the public doesn't think about them. And so whether it is the older adult who requires better funding to make sure that their care is what it should be, or whether it's the staff providing exceptional care, all of those components of society need more attention, need more love, frankly, from society, and they need to be treated as the heroes they are, which includes ensuring through the state and federal government that they are compensated as well as they deserve to be.
You know, and I think some of the things we've talked about show exactly what you just described, in that very early on, when many of the most serious cases of COVID-19 and the deaths were in nursing facilities, that it was getting a lot of attention. But then once the vaccination started and we heard that a majority of residents were vaccinated, it was like, okay, the attention has turned away now from those vulnerable residents of homes, and now it's on to something else. So maybe an example of just what you described. You know, Adam, I'm curious, what are some of the unique challenges faced by nonprofits? I mean, you've talked about Medicaid rates and that kind of thing. But as nonprofits, what are some of the unique challenges that you're facing?
Well, you know, nonprofits focus on their missions, and they exist for the purpose, in this case, of serving older adults. So everything that they do is focused on that. There is no focus on making sure shareholders get value. It's all about making sure that people get the care they need. And so ensuring better pay and benefits is a priority. Making sure that food quality and engagement activities are as robust as they possibly can, so that people live full lives, even if they may have health or mobility challenges or cognitive challenges. And I don't think that's necessarily unique to nonprofits, but I think that the attention paid to it, the priority put on it above a profit, is a fundamental difference. And so that means that decisions are made differently. It means that money is allocated differently, because the end result, the end desire, is different.
We have a question here from Keith in Harrisburg. Wanted to talk about the payback rounds. Jim, I hate to single you out, but what are we talking about for staff members as far as what they're paid?
Well, I think as we talk about as we talk about pay and we talk about what we as not-for-profits do, there are two factors to the equation. First is the amount of money that, actually there are three. First is the amount of money they are paid. Second is the support that organizations provide the benefits. But thirdly, there is the number of staff that's provided. As an organization, our organization has as its benchmark that we are always in the top 25th percentile of pay, regardless of the direct service position. So depending on the marketplace, a nursing assistant can make anywhere between $12 an hour and $18 an hour. There's probably a few outliers that are above the $18 an hour of staff that have been with us for a significant number of years. So it is not a hugely wealth-producing kind of position, but I can also tell you that we do pay particular in a very competitive fashion. And as a result, between the benefits and the pay, our turnover, while it is high, it is not it is lower than the average in the industry. And I think that's not an unusual situation for a not-for-profit provider to be in.
But Jim, I have to say that we know that quality, that there is a difference in quality sometimes. And there are some facilities that are understaffed and don't pay as well. And sometimes the residents don't get the kind of quality care that they may in your facilities. Adam, how do you keep your members? How do they maintain that consistency so that the residents are getting quality care all the time?
Again, our members exist for the purpose of providing that quality care, the quality services. And so depending on how things play out financially, there are some tough decisions being made. I can give you an example. Earlier this year, a nonprofit, a very good one in the Pittsburgh area, said the Medicaid rates are so bad that we don't think we can provide quality care anymore. And they couldn't find someone to purchase their nursing home who they believed would provide care or could provide quality care. And so they decided to shut their community down altogether. They found new homes for each of those people in places that could provide quality care. And they said, we're not going to do it anymore. We have some other members in different parts of the state who in the past 6 months, we've got four of them who have sold facilities because they couldn't afford to do it anymore. And so our members are not going to provide subpar care. They're going to do what they need to do, or they're going to stop doing it. And I think that is the critical message here, that if aging services are not funded adequately, access to quality care for older Pennsylvanians will suffer. And as I said, we're starting to see that because we're starting to see great providers make really tough decisions. And even those that are not making decisions to close or to sell facilities are in all different parts of the state reducing the number of nursing home beds that they have available. Sometimes it's 10 beds less than they used to. Sometimes it's 100 or 150 beds fewer than they used to. And that means that many fewer older adults getting great care who are forced to go somewhere else. We want to make sure that doesn't happen. We want to make sure that all of our services are funded the way that they should be. All of our staff are paid the way that they should be so that older adults can receive the care that they deserve.
Adam Marles is president and CEO of Leading Edge PA. James Bernardo, president and CEO of Presbyterian Senior Living. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, autism research, and we'll also talk about historic sites in Pennsylvania reopening. It's coming up on tomorrow's program. One day last month, a man climbed a sycamore tree in Little Chickies Park in Mount Joy in Lancaster County and removed a baby great horned owl from its nests, leaving behind the owl's mother and a sibling. The man was legally permitted to remove the owlet and train it for use in a rare ancient form of hunting called falconry. Many people were angry over the removal of the owl, but they didn't seem to know much about falconry. So that's what we're here to talk about today. Our guest is Michael Quiroga, who is president of the Pennsylvania Falconry and Hawk Trust. Mr. Quiroga, thank you very much for being with us today. Your sport, and I've heard some people call it an art form, has gotten a lot of attention because of this incident in Mount Joy last month. First of all, talk about that a little bit. What happened with that man climbing the tree? Was that the right thing to do?
Well, legally, yes. Ethically, no. Our club is taking that stance. You know, what he did, you know, is perfectly legal. We're allowed to take young birds, albeit, you know, on a very limited basis. And very few are actually taken from the state of Pennsylvania. The idea of taking it in front of people that have cameras set up and stuff like that, that's not really morally responsible. You know, it's like shooting a deer in a, you know, in somebody's front yard. Is it legal? It could be, you know, depending on the circumstance. You know, ethically, no, I wouldn't do that.
But when you say doing it in front of people who have a camera set up and all that, I mean, would it have been better if he would have done it without anyone there to witness it?
Not in that location. That was a well-known nest. There are other owls to be taken. And in the long run, as long as you leave an owl in the nest, that survivability rate of that particular bird would go sky high. Unfortunately, there's a 80 to 90% mortality rate on all first-year birds of prey. Removing a young actually helps the others in the nest survive.
So is that common, though, that there would be two owlets and a falconer would, you know, remove, whether it's an owl or another bird of prey,
right,
with that 80 to 90% mortality rate you were talking about? Is that common for people who practice your sport to climb a tree and remove a small animal?
It's common. Typically, though, we trap birds in the fall and you know, train them up to use for falconry. These are birds that have already learned how to, you know, obviously fly and hunt a bit on their own. And then we trap them up, shape their behavior a little bit, fly with them during the winter, which that's usually where those first-year birds die that first winter. The ones that have not gained the great skills for hunting and they're down in weight, come that first snowfall, they're usually dead. We keep them. We keep them parasite-free. We keep them fed on a regular basis. They actually learn to use us to aid in kicking out their prey. Come the spring, we are finished with them. They're getting ready to molt, and also they're getting of the age where they can breed. We actually release them back into the wild. So the number of people that actually will climb a tree and take a young bird from a nest, it's probably in the single digits in the state of Pennsylvania.
Hmm. You know, I'm curious. You just touched on a few of them, but these young birds of prey that die during the wintertime, what usually is their cause of death? What are some of the causes of death?
Number one, starvation. Number two, parasites of all things. As well as diseases such as West Nile virus has decimated quite a few birds. We've had, even bald eagles, are dying from West Nile virus, which is, quite prevalent out there right now. You have, all your typical, parasites, parasitic worms and bugs and stuff. It's the little things that kill you.
Hmm. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalk@witf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We do have a question from a listener, Emily. Says, the biggest ethical dilemma I see with this is taking a baby away from its mom. Are there other factors we should be taking into consideration? Can it survive properly without its mother?
Oh, like I said, it has a much higher chance of surviving in the hands of a capable, falconer. To be a falconer in Pennsylvania, you not only have to first start off with your hunting license, you have to find someone who will sponsor you for 2 years. You have to build your facilities that have to meet or exceed federal specifications, and then you have to take a 150-question multiple-choice test at the Game Commission. All of this is to, keep the bird healthy, and, you don't even want to bend a feather on the bird. So, like I say, like modern zoos are fantastic places these days because the animals and the birds and reptiles are kept parasite-free and they're fed on a regular basis. That doesn't happen in the wild. Nature is not kind.
So what kind of birds of prey are we talking about?
Well, typically we use the most common is red-tailed hawks, very, very prevalent here in the state of Pennsylvania. Another common bird is a goshawk. Now, you find them in the northern woods. Their populations have been affected a little bit by climate change, but we also have the expertise to breed these birds in captivity. So there are a lot of falconers that have captive-bred goshawks, as well as harris hawks, which are found in areas like Texas and Arizona. That's a very sociable bird and adapts itself very well to falconry. Then you have your falcons, your peregrines and gyr falcons and prairie falcons. Peregrine falcons, of course, nest here in Pennsylvania, and fortunately because of the efforts of the falconers, they've returned to the state. We release birds up in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. They actually create nesting sites, and their population was so robust that the Game Commission the federal government removed peregrines not only from endangered, not even to threaten, just to protect it. So they went two steps down the protection ladder. Which is really an attribute to our efforts of using ancient falconry methods to reintroduce these birds back into the wild.
All right, so let's talk about what falconry really is. I mean, you're using these birds of prey to hunt. In what way?
True.
I mean, how do you train them, and what species do they hunt? How do they go about it?
Well, instead of using a shotgun or a rifle or a bow, we're using a bird of prey. This is a ancient art that goes back close to 4,000 years, and historically is really steeped in Pennsylvania history. And what it involves is it's as close to the predator-prey relationship as a human can be. The birds of prey are opportunistic. A lot of times you'll see a marsh hawk following a farmer that's cutting hay. As he cuts hay, he's disturbing birds and mice and voles and animals like that. Well, the marsh hawk will follow the tractor. Well, the same thing happens with the red-tailed hawk that we would use. It learns that, if I sit on this guy's gauntlet, and I'm watching his dog, and that dog stops and goes on point, I'm going to have something to chase and hunt. And when and that's what usually occurs, my dog will go on point. I'll go over to the area where the bush where I think the dog's pointing to, either just kick it with my foot or just give the dog a nice gentle tap on the back of the head, say okay, and she flushes it. Out goes the game, typically rabbits, and the hawk is off and after on pursuit. Does it catch every time? No. I'm typically, if I catch one head of game a day, I'm happy. If I wanted to kill a lot of rabbits and really fill the game larder, I would pick up a shotgun and have a beagle. But it's a little more sophisticated with a hawk. Another way of hawking is to go out with and let your bird fly free. And they learned since we're chasing up the game, they follow along. And in the case of some parks and or woodlands and stuff, we'll go through there and hopefully kick out a squirrel. And they hunt squirrels. So it's it's exciting to see, very exciting. We're organically harvesting our game. We're not putting any shot into it. And when we have a miss, we have a clean miss.
But when you talk about hunting with a shotgun, small game that you've been describing, rabbits mm-hmm. or squirrels, something like that, many of the people that are successful in their hunt of rabbits and squirrels, they eat what they kill. What happens to the animals that are captured and killed by the birds?
All right. If you shoot a your rabbit, you would, you know, take the hindquarters, the back straps, and make Hassenpfeffer. I do the same thing. However, the rest of the rabbit would be, you know, considered, you know, waste and disposed of. Not in our case. The hawks would, you know, would eat a lot of the entrails as well as the head, and they get a lot of nutrition, especially from the trace mineral elements in the animals. So, you know, a lot more of the animal gets used in our case. Plus, I don't have to worry about biting into shot.
What you've described, these birds sound like they're pretty smart.
Oh, extremely. Yeah, they're very opportunistic. You know, you can take almost any animal and shape its behavior, and that's what, you know, a lot of this sport is all about. You know, getting that bird to fly in different styles. For each and every type of hawk there is, there are several styles of flying them. I was fortunate enough to have had a golden eagle for a while, and the way you can fly a golden eagle is you can either fly it from the fist, where you're just walking along a big prairie, hoping to kick up a jackrabbit or something, and once it does, the bird takes off from your fist. Or I could fly it from the cliffs, where we're walking along a creek bottom, per se, and just like that red tail falling through the tree, the golden eagle would go from cliff to cliff and follow us and see what, you know, where we're kicking out. Or it could fly from a sewer, where it would shoot up to 1,000 feet, let's say, and you would have your dogs running out in the prairies ahead of it. And once the game got up moving, it would do a wing over and hopefully crash and connect. So there's three different styles right there.
We have a question from Amber, a listener, wants to know what sorts of regulations govern falconry?
We have a lot of regulations. It used to be we had a dual permit. We used to get a permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Pennsylvania Game Commission. And we have our own, you know, set of rules and regulations. There's a whole chapter in the game laws that govern us. And so, you know, we have a, you know, we have an awful lot to follow, and it gets very, very detailed. But it's all for the protection of the birds.
We had another question. Wanted to know if any of these birds ever just said, you know, see ya, and flew away.
Oh, it happens. I mentioned that golden eagle that I used to have. I was flying it near a landfill, and all these crows came off and mobbed it terrible. There were like hundreds of them, and you know, because it's an enemy to the crows. And a group of crows, by the way, is called a murder. Obvious reasons there. That bird shot up to 1,500 feet in seconds. And along the Bald Eagle mountain range in northern Pennsylvania, it got up into the wind currents there and took off heading north. It was March. It was migration season. And that bird went out of my radio. We put radio transmitters on them. And in a matter of a few minutes, it was out of range. 5 years later, 70 miles away from the spot I lost it, that bird was captured on a game camera, and I could tell it was my bird. It had I could see the band on this bird, and that bird was traveling with a female that had a satellite track pack on it for study purposes. Now, the researchers were concerned about the female, but here in the background was my male traveling with it. So, 5 years later, after trapping him, after losing him, he was doing fine. He was probably making babies up in Canada.
We only have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to, you know, thank you for being on the program and explaining some of this. But you probably weren't real happy that this is how many people learned about the sport of falconry, is this incident in Lancaster County. In about 30 seconds or less, can you just talk about that a little bit?
Well, in any sport, you always have some individuals that are not part of an organization that follow ethical, you know, leanings, and that really give us a bad name. This guy is not a member of our organization. Just any character can cause problems. And it's a shame we have knee-jerk reactions to someone that does something like this.
Michael Kuriga is president of the Pennsylvania Falconry and Hawk Trust. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.